It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Recovering from substance use disorder is challenging, to say the least. Not only the vigilance required to stay clean, but also the wherewithal to overcome the stigmas in society.
I went to numerous interviews, and I was honest with them because I wasn't going to lie about my charges, and no call back or anything like that, you know. So yeah, that stigma is definitely there, and it's very overwhelming to begin with.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. We'll hear more about life in recovery in just a moment. But first, are America's schools hostile to religion? It's been a contentious issue since the early 60s when the Supreme Court ruled that prayer and school-sponsored Bible readings were unconstitutional. Since then, evangelical Christians have claimed that God and religion have all but been driven out of education, and secular Americans, concerned about blurring the wall between church and state, have been vigilant over any erosion of that separation. But not long ago, liberals and conservatives both thought religious instruction in public schools was a good thing. On WVPB's podcast, Us and Them, in an episode called The Church Lady, host Trey Kay speaks with historian Jonathan Zimmerman about a program in American schools called Weekday Religious Education, or WRE, which started in the early 1920s.
WRE was promoted in the South by pacifists and anti-racists. So I found this amazing testament from a school teacher in North Carolina in 1943 named Louise Bashford, in which she says, the reason we need religious teaching in schools, weekday religious education, is we have to teach that Christ was the Prince of Peace. Remember, this is 43, this is wartime. And also, by the way, we have to teach that Christ doesn't see color. And again, that reminds us about the way that religion was absolutely central to the civil rights appeal. And people wanted to use schools to promote religion as a way of reinforcing that appeal. Now, let me be clear, not everybody did. And one of the fascinating stories about WRE and about the teaching of religion in school is how many different religious communities tried to seize on it. So if you look at the burgeoning evangelical movement in the 40s and 50s, they too try to get in on weekday religious education, but they teach a very different set of messages. And what they say is, we shouldn't be using the Bible to teach about the evils of race or of racism or Jim Crow. We should be using it to bring every child to Jesus. Because the Bible says, if you don't have that, you're going to hell.
For most of America's history, kids prayed and read the Bible in school. But in 1962 and 63, the Supreme Court issued two landmark rulings saying schools could not require students to participate in Bible readings or prayers. The first case came from New York and the second from Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, schools were required by law to begin each day with Bible readings. Kids could be excused if they had a written note from their parents. The Supreme Court said the law violated the First Amendment, which forbids government from establishing a state religion. The case was called Abington School District versus Shemp. The Shemp decision has been characterized as forbidding prayer in school, but John Zimmerman says that's not what it said.
You can pray whenever you want in school. And as far as Bible reading goes, the Shemp case about Bible reading specifically said nothing in this decision prevents you from reading the Bible in school. In fact, we think every educated person should read the Bible and know what it says. What the decision says isn't you can't read the Bible in school, but rather teacher can't lead kids in a ritual in worship from the Bible, which is different from saying you can't read the Bible. It's an important distinction.
Still, Zimmerman says the pair of cases shocked the country.
It wasn't that, oh, we can't pray anymore, because people kept praying, including in school. It was the symbolic fact that the state was now saying that the school couldn't sponsor this. That's what outraged so many people. That is a watershed. The state, which had been pro-religion, was now officially neutral on religion. And that was an enormous, enormous change in the way that Americans thought and lived.
To me, when I hear somebody say they took the Bible out of the school, I think that the implication is they've taken morality out of the school. They've taken the foundation of our society and
pretty much what is going to be left is that the devil is going to get the hindmost, and that our kids are going to be corrupted and go on a slippery slope to hell. Is that what the implication that you hear is?
Yeah, and I think that you know, whether you agree with that or not, I think there's some historical truth to it, insofar as conservatives are right where they say that across most of our history, we did pray in schools, and we did read the Bible for sacramental reasons. And if you're somebody that believes that all morality is rooted in scripture or in religion, I can understand why you would think that if we remove those sacraments from the school, that we'll remove morality as well. I think there is a logic there.
Some religious conservatives believe there have been ugly consequences from the court decisions removing organized prayer and religious instruction from schools. They believe that things started to go downhill for America right away. Again, Jonathan Zimmerman.
You know, you get into 64 and 65, and now you have riots in American cities. I mean, we often think of riots as beginning in the late 60s, but they didn't. There were big riots in Harlem and in Philadelphia in 64, and then obviously in 65 you have the Watts riots.
More than 100 square blocks were decimated by fire and looters, and few buildings were left intact.
What that does is it feeds a sense on the part of a lot of Americans that there's chaos and disorder. And as you were indicating earlier, what you find is, you know, people turning to these school prayer decisions and saying, well, there's a causal arrow here. Just to be clear, I'm not saying that we had riots in the streets because the Bible was taken out of schools. And incidentally, let me emphasize the Bible, even as a document of prayer, was not taken out of the schools. One of the other things I've documented in my work is the different ways that school districts found their way around these decisions. So, for example, the football prayer, the team prayer, that is an artifact of the mid-60s. It was an effort to, and they use this verb, bootleg religion into schools, which is, of course, a football term as well, right? Team prayer begins as an explicit and admitted effort to get around these decisions by creating another venue for prayer. So it's not in the classroom, but okay, it's on the football field.
Are there other workarounds, bootlegs?
Oh, yeah. Courses in the Bible. See, Justice Clark had explicitly said in the Kemp case, nothing we're saying prevents you from teaching the Bible. So a lot of conservatives picked up on that and started teaching Bible courses that were, when we look at them closely, very clearly efforts to evangelize and proselytize, right? Which, of course, is what the court said you can't do, right? It said you can read the Bible in school and you can teach about it, but you can't use the Bible to evangelize and proselytize. But a lot of these Bible courses absolutely did.
What do you think was the legacy of the Supreme Court decisions in 62 and 63?
The legacy has to do with our politics, with the structure and the content of our politics. I think the real legacy is, in the wake of these decisions, a lot of people on the left who had invoked religion routinely and ritualistically as a part of their political program stopped doing so. And conservatives started doing so. So let's take a figure like Jerry Falwell. When Martin Luther King was doing a lot of his freedom rallies in the 60s, Falwell, who was a preacher in Lynchburg, Virginia, said with respect to people like King that preachers should get out of the streets and get back in the pulpits, right? Your job is not to change the world here and now. Your job is to prepare us for the world hereafter, okay? Well, by the early 70s, and especially by Roe v. Wade, which is what Falwell says radicalized him, we see these conservative religionists come into the public sphere in a huge way, saying that their faith has brought them into the public sphere and they want to infuse the public sphere with their faith. But what you see on the left is something the opposite happening, which is people are much less inclined to invoke God and religion in their language and in their rhetoric than they did before these prayer decisions. The prayer decisions aren't the only thing that made a difference, but I do think they were critical in starting to change the structure of our politics with respect to religion.
We've been listening to an excerpt from West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Us and Them podcast episode, The Church Lady. To hear the entire episode, download the Us and Them podcast from iTunes, Stitcher, NPR One, or Radio Public. You can also listen online at wvpublic.org. Tonight, West Virginia Public Broadcasting will co-sponsor a screening of the documentary Recovery Boys at the University of Charleston's Geary Auditorium at 7 p.m. It's part of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Recovery Project, a focus on substance use disorder and the various paths to recovery. Part of this effort is sharing stories of those in recovery. Executive producer Suzanne Higgins recently visited with Kelly Strickler of Huntington.
Overnight shift work is exhausting, paying bills, stressful, and never-ending. But to talk to Kelly Strickler of Huntington, West Virginia, who clocks in at a local bakery at 11 at night and clocks out at 7 the next morning, you'd think she won the lottery.
I look forward to getting up and going to work. I get to go to work today. You know, I get to pay bills.
Kelly lives with substance use disorder and will mark a fourth year in recovery next month. Kelly says she smoked weed and drank alcohol as a teenager, but it was pain pills she got from a friend when she couldn't afford to go to the dentist for a toothache that hooked her right away. Eventually, that led to shooting up heroin because it was cheaper and a much bigger high. Her 16-year addiction led to a life of crime on the streets with multiple near-death experiences.
I guess they found me in the bathroom and I was gone. And then when they would bring me back, I would be mad because they brought me back. I wanted to die. And then the last time I went to jail, we had started a Bible study group, praying, doing Bible study. And I remember sitting in my cell one night and I was praying and I got on my knees and said, God, I can't do this no more. And I was just repenting and asked Jesus Christ into my life. And that night I knew something was different.
That was September 16th, 2014, the day Kelly's attorney agreed to fight for her one last time.
They was getting ready to sentence me to prison. So I asked my lawyer, please don't give up on me. And I'll remind you, she had done got me, three chances. I was on my fourth chance. And she said, Kelly, she said, I'm going to try to get you in drug court. She said, if you mess it up this time, she said, I'm going to kick your butt myself. And she meant it. So I was released that day, and I was accepted into drug court. That's where my journey has started with the path of recovery.
You must have known folks that didn't make it.
Quite a few. And I've seen a few. When I first came to recovery, someone said, get you a dress because you'll be attending love funerals. And I've known a lot of people pass away. A lot of people. Probably over 30. So, yeah. And some that's been in recovery for quite some time and they go out that one time and use, and that's the last time.
Drug court ordered Kelly to attend education classes and Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. It also included regular random drug screenings, daily therapy, and community service. She says the rehab treatment she received from several community programs and agencies helped her deal with mental health issues, teaching her the coping skills to live a sober life in recovery.
The resentments, the hurts, the abandonment issues, all those things that normally I wouldn't have opened up to anybody about. That's one of the reasons why I was getting high, was to hide all those feelings. You know, I didn't want to share that with nobody because I've been hurt so many times, I couldn't trust no one.
Since graduating drug court, Kelly has been a sponsor and a peer counselor, committed to helping others as they enter recovery.
You know, I know when I first came into recovery, when I was looking for a job, I went to numerous interviews and I was honest with them because I wasn't going to lie about my charges, and no callback or anything like that, you know. So yeah, that stigma is definitely there and it's very overwhelming to begin with, you know, and then come into sobriety and having a young girl, you know, that's 10 years old, not knowing how to be a parent, you know. It's very scary. And then, of course, you're trying to make up for the past. I didn't know how to work. I didn't know how to go look for a job. And let's talk about a resume. I hadn't worked for over 12 years.
So Kelly went back to school and graduated college with honors. She remains grateful to Drug Court and all the community agencies and their staff who have helped her along the way.
I love them. I'm grateful for them. They're still, most of them are still in my life. You know, one thing I've learned is people come and go in your life, but you learn a lesson from each and every one of them. But I'm very grateful for them. They help mold me into the lady that I'm becoming.
It hasn't been easy, and every day Kelly must recommit to sobriety, but she says she's in a great place now.
It's simply amazing. The things that I have now is things I used to pray for that I never thought was possible, you know, having my own roof over my head, having my own house. I dreamed of having a dog and cat and being able to take them for a walk and feed them or just go to a laundromat or to be able to spend Christmas with my daughter and not have to go get high. I'm a mother. I'm a friend. You know, I'm a daughter. You know, I get to help others. You know, and I'm very grateful for that.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Huntington.
Again, that was West Virginia Public Broadcasting is co-sponsoring a free screening of Recovery Boys, a new documentary by Academy Award-nominated filmmaker and West Virginian Elaine Sheldon. The film follows four young West Virginians as they battle substance use disorder and attempt to reinvent their lives and reenter society. The screening will be followed by a Q&A with film participants. That's tonight at 7 at Geary Auditorium, the University of Charleston.